Hello. On this week's program, we visit the Woodmere Art Museum in Chestnut Hill to see a collection of drawings by Benjamin West, a colonial-era superstar artist. Susan Lewis considers Lyric Fest and its upcoming recital of songs written by composers with Philadelphia connections. Historian Thomas Keels delves into the 1960s destruction of the birthplace of Benjamin Rush, Philadelphia's forgotten founding father. And Jason Piper takes us to the 47th annual Philadelphia Antique Show. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Fine arts aficionados will know that the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts, the country's first art school, was founded in 1805 by Charles Wilson Peale. A less well-known fact is that Britain's first art school, the Royal Academy of the Arts, was co-founded in 1768 by Pennsylvania native Benjamin West, a mentor and teacher of Peale's. West was born in Swarthmore, now a Philadelphia suburb, but in the 1700s a frontier town. Although 30 years his junior, West is said to have been close friends with Benjamin Franklin, and there are many parallels between their two lives. Both were self-taught, creative powerhouses, much acclaimed and celebrated in their respective fields, Franklin in politics and science, West in the fine arts. And centuries before mass communication, both were well known outside America, Franklin in France, West in England. What perhaps differentiates the two is their respective levels of recognition today. A new exhibition of Benjamin West's drawings is now at the Woodmere Art Museum in Chestnut Hill, where Douglas Pascal is curator of collections. When I met with him yesterday morning, I asked him if he thought Benjamin West is as well-renowned today as he deserves.
I don't think he's as well-renowned as he should be, but I don't think any American artist is as well-renowned as they should be. West was, by any measure, the first American superstar artist. He was this wunderkind growing up outside of Philadelphia on the frontier, learning in the way that most artists then learned in an apprenticeship system with other artists. There were no academies in America at the time. There actually were very few academies anywhere in the world at the time. Most artists had to learn in this piecemeal way. And he used what training he could derive here to bring himself up as high as he could, to a level that at the time was as high as any other American artist. That was not enough in his mind. It was not enough to the mind of those who were supporting him, his patrons here in Philadelphia. And they bankrolled his trip to Italy to study from the old masters. This, too, was the way that artists learned. The way you wanted to increase your skill was to go see, how did Michelangelo do it? Michelangelo wasn't around, so you had to go see his works and study them. This is what West did. And for 3 years, he was in Italy looking at the works of the old masters, looking at the top contemporary artists in Italy at the time as well. He became part of a circle of artists, mostly expatriates, Britons and a Swiss painter and Germans in Rome, who would become the initiators of what we now today call neoclassicism. This was a style that didn't exist yet. These artists were just starting their first important works at the moment that West is being introduced to them, and at the moment when he's becoming a part of their circle, and in fact, he too becomes a pioneer of the neoclassical movement. For this to happen for any artist is something of a feat. For it to happen for this frontier provincial from Pennsylvania was wholly unimaginable. And the patrons in Rome also were just as shocked as anyone else.
And quite remarkable as well, his role in the founding of what we would call today arts education. This, as you say, a provincial person from the colonies who becomes involved with the great and the good in England and is the second president of the Royal Academy and one of its founders.
Absolutely. I mean, when he goes to England after his sojourn in Italy, he's going there thinking that, oh, he's going to come back to the States, he'll continue to have a career over here. He is having dangled in front of him, though, the prospect of royal patronage. And he lingers in England, accepting commissions for portraits and some history paintings, until finally the royal patronage does come through. He becomes the painter to the king. This also, just totally out of the blue, something that irks most British artists of the time considerably is they're not getting that patronage. But in fact, it was the adventurous nature of his work, the indisputable power of the works that he was producing and their novelty that recommended him to the king so that he became the foremost history painter in England. And at the time, Britain really didn't have many strong history painters until West arrived.
Ironic, an American should teach them how to paint history.
Absolutely.
Woodmere Art Museum Curator of Collections, Douglas Pascal. Hail Sacred Genius, drawings by Benjamin West from the Swarthmore College Collection, is at the Woodmere through June 8th.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Art songs, poetry set to music, became popular in 19th century Europe. In the mid-20th century, song recitals involving one or a small number of performers were a good vehicle for singers of serious music who, for one reason or another, didn't perform on the opera stage. Today, a group in Philadelphia is giving the song recital a modern twist, with programs as varied as the tastes of the people on the stage and in the audience. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis looks and listens to Lyric Fest, founded by lovers of song and now in its fifth anniversary concert series.
Whether it was Hush Little Baby, Don't Say a Word, or The Wheels on the Bus Go Round and Round, or some other tune, chances are good somewhere, sometime, someone from your earliest memories sang to you. And whether you think of yourself as a singer now, you probably learned to sing along.
People sing. It seems to have a direct correlation to our human emotions.
Randy Morazzo's love of song led her to join with fellow singer Suzanne Duplantis and pianist Laura Ward to found a group called Lyric Fest, so named in a brainstorming session around a kitchen table.
We kept throwing out words and decided the sound of this is what we want it to be because it's sort of a festival of songs.
Lyric Fest founders are passionate advocates of the art song, which starts with a poem, put to music by a composer, then interpreted by a singer, and often a pianist or other instrumentalist. But Lyric Fest goes beyond art songs to Broadway, opera, choral works, whatever vocal music strikes the fancy of the founders. Every year, each of four thematic programs include a mix of composers, poets, and styles, from love songs to jazz, from traditional to contemporary. Laura Ward says the program this weekend is an example.
We have this fabulous song by George Walker on a text of Emily Dickinson called I Went to Heaven. It's very delicate. Then we have George Crumb, where we amplify the piano. It's from a set of songs called Apparitions. Walt Whitman wrote these poems after Abraham Lincoln was assassinated. I'm brushing the strings inside the piano. I'm playing notes. I mean, this sound, it fills up the whole sanctuary.
This eclectic mix, says Ward, has something for everyone and lends the concerts a certain element of surprise.
We have a saying in Lyric Fest, if you don't like what you're hearing, just wait 5 minutes.
It's so true. One time someone got up and walked out.
It was like at the beginning of the, Tales from the Exotic, our last program. We had this wonderful song of John Harbison very close to the beginning called Japan. And it's kind of weird and kind of pointillistic and angular, you know. We had this wonderful singer who just sang it beautifully. And this couple just kind of looked shocked and got up and walked out right at the beginning of the program. We wanted to say, wait, wait, it's going to change.
The music of this weekend's program, Old City New Music, is all by composers who have lived, worked, or studied in Philadelphia. Illustrating the whimsical tone Lyric Fest can bring to its programs, Randy Morazzo says it kicks off with a song by Leonard Bernstein, who studied at Curtis, called I Hate Music.
It's short, it's almost childlike, and to start a song concert with something that has such a sense of humor, we decided would be a great way to get our audience laughing from the start.
Following laughter comes love, at least on this program. Michael Jupstrom, a young composer now living in Philadelphia, composed the short love song, I Would Live in Your Love, using a poem by Sarah Teasdale for his sister's wedding.
It uses imagery of the ocean and of moving waves in order to sort of depict the flow of love. And in my piano part, especially in the piano part, there's a lot of rocking motion, undulating fifths back and forth that don't quite line up. And I did that in an effort to sort of evoke water. Over the top, the vocal line is pretty simple and direct, melodic, and only occasionally does the voice sort of join in with the ocean motif.
Using Philadelphia composers ties into another goal of Lyric Fest, to foster community. It's this musical community that first attracted Jupstrom to the city after he finished his studies in Michigan. Now he works as a pianist, teacher, and composer of everything from instrumental works, he has a string quartet premiering at the end of the month in Carnegie Hall, to songs and choral work. Laura Ward says Lyric Fest can also attract high-quality singers.
They're willing to come and do this because most of the time they are singing opera. For these programs, they can just come in, learn four or five, six pieces, period, and then be with their colleagues. We have a really good time.
Networking with colleagues also appeals to artists like Jupstrom.
I need to know that my music has a place for musicians and has a place for listeners, and that I'm part of a musical community. As a younger composer, especially, you do have intermittent work. So a part of your time is spent discovering the next opportunity.
And discovery is also what Lyric Fest is about. Discovering new music, new performers, and composers, says Laura Ward.
Some people no one will have heard of, Richard Wargo. He happens to be an elevator operator somewhere, and as a hobby is a composer, and his wonderful Chekhov trilogy was performed at AVA about 10 years ago, and we're doing an aria from his Chekhov trilogy.
Born around a kitchen table, this kitchen sink approach to music making results in a kind of joyous and intimate jubilee, says Ward.
Sometimes the singers stand right in front of the people and they sing right into their faces. And how often do you get to hear great singers that close? I mean, you feel it, you know what I mean?
Lyric Fest is another way to appreciate an art form that was perhaps among the first. Started when someone saw, heard, or touched something beautiful and just felt like singing.
I'm expecting you. WRTI's Susan Lewis. Lyric Fest's Old City, New Song, Philadelphia Composers, featuring the premiere of Nicholas White's The Aimless Song, performed with the Pennsylvania Girl Choir, takes place this afternoon at the Presbyterian Church of Chestnut Hill, and tomorrow afternoon at the First Presbyterian Church of Philadelphia. Philadelphia is renowned for its historic buildings. Every year, tourists flock to the city to see such landmarks as Independence Hall, Christ Church, and Carpenter's Hall. Yet a surprising number of Philadelphia's notable structures have disappeared over the years, thanks to greed, incompetence, or neglect. Last year, historian Thomas Keels documented many of these buildings in his book, Forgotten Philadelphia, Lost Architecture of the Quaker City. Now, Keels follows up on one of those lost structures, the birthplace of Benjamin Rush, Philadelphia's forgotten founding father.
The corner of Keswick Road and Rayland Road, in the far northeast section of Philadelphia, is an interesting mixture of country and city. I'm surrounded by very attractive, very neat rows of brick townhouses. At the same time, there are many trees. Just off of the corner of Rayland and Keswick is a historical marker, which reads Benjamin Rush, 1745 to 1813. Physician, humanitarian, educator, patriot leader. He signed the Declaration of Independence, opposed slavery, and supported public health and social reforms. Known as Father of American Psychiatry, his house of birth stood here until 1969.
Benjamin Rush was born on Christmas Eve, 1745, in a stone farmhouse in rural Byberry that had sheltered five generations of the Rush family. When he was six, his father died. His mother was forced to sell the farm and move her family to Philadelphia, where she opened a grocery store. She did well enough to send Benjamin to the College of New Jersey, precursor to Princeton University, from which he graduated at age 14. After that, he embarked on a prominent career as one of Colonial Philadelphia's most notable physicians and most ardent patriots. According to David Contasta, professor at Chestnut Hill College and author of numerous books on Philadelphia history, Rush was an extraordinarily accomplished Philadelphian.
He was a physician. He was a signer of the Declaration of Independence. He was one of the delegates to the Constitutional Convention. He apparently did a lot of preparation with Lewis and Clark. So I guess today we would call him a polymath.
Yet Rush never achieved the same immortality as his fellow Philadelphian, Benjamin Franklin, due to his lack of diplomacy and opinionated nature. During the Revolution, according to Contasta, Benjamin Rush even thought that George Washington should be fired as commander-in-chief of the American army.
And later on, when Washington did succeed and did prevail and became such a great hero, even a demigod, that didn't help Rush. So I think that's another reason, too. He apparently was a very querulous, outspoken person, and that did not redound to his credit either.
Throughout Rush's long and controversial career, his childhood home in Byberry remained a paradise lost in his memory. In July 1812, the elderly physician paid one last visit to his birthplace. Here, Rush, portrayed by actor Richard Lee, describes the visit in a letter to his friend, former President John Adams.
The building, which is of stone, bears marks of age and decay. Before the house flows a small but deep creek abounding in panfish. The farm consists of 90 acres, all in a highly cultivated state. I knew the owner to be in such easy circumstances that I did not ask him his price for it, but begged, if he should ever incline to sell it, to make me, or one of my surviving sons, the first offer, which he promised to do.
Benjamin Rush died in 1813. And his birthplace remained in private hands for the next 150 years. By 1966, the house was described as impoverished and shabby. At that time, a real estate developer was building an apartment complex named Rushwood on the site. Members of the American Medical Association proposed moving the vacant farmhouse to Independence Mall as a shrine to American medicine. Instead, in March 1969, a demolition crew from the city's Department of Licenses and Inspections knocked down the structure, by mistake. Their record showed the Benjamin Rush birthplace at its original address. But the real estate developer had run a small service road named Railand Road for construction vehicles next to the house. The new road and the new address convinced the L&I inspectors to fire up their bulldozers. Historian Marty Munitza is also an engineer who designs communication systems for Lockheed Martin. Speaking at the site of the Rush birthplace, he describes the confusion that led to its demise.
There was an investigation to see, you know, if there was any historical value of the property because it appeared so old, it was stone construction. But the closest record of such of a historical home existing was at the corner of Red Lion and Keswick and not at the corner of Raylan and Keswick. And as such, they didn't find that this house was historically significant, and they condemned it.
Sadly, the bureaucratic bungling that caused the demise of the Benjamin Rush birthplace is not unique. John Andrew Gallery, executive director of the Preservation Alliance of Greater Philadelphia, believes that miscommunication between the Philadelphia Historical Commission and the Department of Licenses and Inspections has doomed other historic properties.
The commission has had a difficulty in keeping the Philadelphia Register of Historic Places up to date in an electronic format that other people could easily access, including L&I. And up until recently, at least, the commission and L&I were operating off of different systems of information. so that something that was listed in the commission's office might not have been flagged in the property address list that L&I was using.
The destruction of the Rush birthplace was only the first leg of a convoluted odyssey. Local residents paid to have the stones transferred to Byberry State Hospital, where they remained for 3 decades. In 2003, the Friends of Pequessing Watershed convinced the Pennsylvania Bureau of State Parks to move the stones to Fort Washington State Park in White Marsh Township, Montgomery County. Joshua Bruce, park manager, doubts that many of the stones are actually from the Rush birthplace.
There's no name tags or anything on them, and there's no carvings, and there were lots of buildings in that area. I mean, it sounds nice to say that, oh, these are definitely Benjamin Rush rocks, I guess, but nobody's proved it to me.
Joshua Bruce took me to the isolated site where the Pennsylvania Bureau of State Parks had deposited several truckloads of building debris in 2003. There appear to be between 50 and 100 stones, barely enough to build a small wall, let alone a historic farmhouse. Despite the lessons that should have been learned from the destruction of the Rush birthplace, historic buildings continue to fall to the wrecker's ball in Philadelphia. Meanwhile, the historical marker at Rayland and Keswick Roads remains the only monument to the Benjamin Rush birthplace. Marty Munitza spearheaded the effort to secure the marker, and he still hopes to see the remaining stones of the Rush birthplace return to life in some form at Benjamin Rush State Park. He acknowledges, however, that the impetus to restore this house and to preserve other historic structures in Philadelphia must begin at the individual level.
We need to be vigilant because once these homes are demolished, they don't come back.
At this point, it seems highly unlikely that the Benjamin Rush birthplace will come back, except perhaps as a pair of gateposts marking the entrance to Benjamin Rush State Park. But for now, it remains a sad example of the limitations to the historic preservation process in Philadelphia.
Historian Thomas Cales. He's the author of Forgotten Philadelphia, Lost Architecture of the Quaker City, published last year by Temple University Press. His latest book about Philadelphia's Rittenhouse Square will be released this June. A long-running local tradition continues this weekend with the opening today of the 47th annual Philadelphia Antique Show. This year, the event takes on a nautical theme to correspond with the show's new venue in South Philadelphia. As WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, the show is a celebration of that human passion to explore and collect fragments of history.
Held at Drexel University's 33rd Street Armory for 46 years, the Antique Show is now settling into its new home in the Philadelphia Cruise Terminal at Pier 1 in the Navy Yard. The event, widely considered a premier American antiques and decorative arts show, was forced to find a new residence because of Drexel's plans to renovate the armory. This year's show chair, Karen Drury, says the annual event was started in 1962 as a project of the Board of Women Visitors,
which is a women's committee that still exists today to fundraise and do nice things for the hospital that can't be done by other departments.
Drury says a driven and talented woman named Allie Brown was very influential in organizing the first Philadelphia Antiques Show at the Armory, which was and still is a fundraiser for the University of Pennsylvania Hospital.
Mrs. Brown was so concerned about making money that she prayed that it would rain on preview party night so that she could collect more revenue at the coat check.
Drury says over the last 4 decades, the show has raised over $15 million for Penn's health system. Organizers hope to raise a further $1 million this year. But while the amount of money raised through underwriting and ticket sales has steadily grown from year to year, what's remained the same is that the show annually features guided tours, lectures, and 50 dealers and galleries. The exhibitors display items ranging from vintage folk and fine art to old furniture, ceramics, porcelain, jewelry, and textiles, all of which can be described as antiques. But what makes something an antique?
It used to be anything over 100 years was considered an antique.
Diana Biddle, who's been an antique dealer for over 3 decades, has been coming to the Philadelphia Antiques Show for 27 years.
Of course, that just keeps changing every year, so the criteria is no longer, it doesn't have to be Queen Anne or Chippendale or Federal. It can be anything now. It's whether there's a definite definition. I don't think it holds anymore because there's so many people interested in different things.
Biddle says that just as the answer to what constitutes an antique is hard to nail down, So too is the value of any specific item.
You could get 10 people to come in and look at the same table, and they're all going to come up with a different price. It's based on comparables to the best of your knowledge as to what's out there and what it may have gone for at auction or what you've seen it for sale for somewhere else. So it's very subjective as to what somebody will tell you something is worth.
In estimating the value of something, experts consider many variables, such as condition, rarity, and proof of authenticity or provenance. Diana Biddle's area of expertise is 18th and early 19th century American furniture and nautical art, which makes this year's antique exhibition theme especially resonant for her. Every year, the show presents a loan exhibit, which becomes the feature and theme of the entire event. Past loan exhibits included Philadelphia Empire furniture, Schuylkill villas, and Gothic-style revival in Philadelphia. This time around, it's Philadelphia Maritime, a collection of maritime art and antiques on loan from public and private collections across the region, curated by the Independent Seaport Museum in Philadelphia. Show chair Karen Drury says the choice of this theme was no coincidence.
When we realized that we had to move, we wanted to tie something in that would make it even more meaningful. So we chose Philadelphia Maritime Antiques to celebrate our move after all these years to the Navy Yard.
In the spirit of a show that centers on historic items, the maritime history of Philadelphia is very important, according to Craig Bruns, curator at the Independent Seaport Museum and of this year's Antique Show Loan Exhibit.
The city wouldn't be here without the two rivers that we're on, the Delaware River and the Schuylkill River. The city was born at the banks of those rivers.
Bruns says at a time when waterways were the highways, Philadelphia's geographic location made it a major port and thus a major city in 18th and 19th century America. Reflecting this heritage, the maritime exhibit includes nautical instruments, sailor art, an 1840s Jack Tar shop figure, a figurehead carved by William Rush, and the painted wooden boxes that once contained Stephen Girard's maritime merchant records. Craig Bruns says objects like these, and antiques in general, draw people in because they give us a deep sense of the past.
You can read, of course, history books about the past, but when you actually see an object from the past, you pick up these different nuances that are beyond words, beyond the verbal, that give you an insight to what it was like.
Perhaps this helps explain why some people can be such avid antique collectors. They have a love for imagining the past. To be sure, there's also a business side to antiquing. There's money to be made. But Diana Biddle says more often than not, the motivation is more emotional.
If you're a collector, it's like a gene. It's like a gene flaw. You get so passionate about what you love. And I think with dealers, we all have something we're passionate about in this business. It is incredibly fun to be able to find it, to search for it. The search is half the fun to begin with. And to bid on it, auction or whatever, it's phenomenal.
Biddle says after 47 years, the Philadelphia Antiques Show remains one of the top shows in the country, a destination for dealers and collectors from all over. 10,000 people are expected to pass through this year's show. With decades of practice, about 300 women volunteers run the charity event, and much of the show's success is to their credit. But the long-running event that's held each April is also a sign that the human urge to search for, browse through, and collect pieces of history, from a painting to furniture to maritime instruments, is strong.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. The Philadelphia Antique Show is at the cruise terminal at Pier 1 in the Navy Yard through Tuesday. And that's our show. Our thanks this week to Lauren Sharp and Heike Ross Palmier. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore. And I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.